I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. After a short year of retirement, Kansas City's former police chief is back in uniform as Jackson County's newly elected sheriff. Today we'll speak with Daryl Forte, the first African-American to lead the department, about the shocking discoveries he's already made serving as interim sheriff, and we'll ask him how he plans to improve what he describes as a dysfunctional department. Then, before you make a holiday toast, consider making it with a bit of the bubbly. There are a lot of choices when it comes to sparkling wines, so we've invited Master of Wine Doug Frost to help us sort it all out, just in time for the season. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Daryl Forte just couldn't stay away. The former chief of the Kansas City Police Department is now the newly elected sheriff of Jackson County. And to hear Forte talk about it, he inherited a mess. He has called the department that he took over this year as the interim chief dysfunctional. And Forte says he came across something scandalous or unethical nearly every week. In short, he was shocked by what he found. And now, based on the outcome of the November election, control of the county jail will shift from the executive to Sheriff Forte. Sheriff Forte joins me now, and congratulations on your election. So nice to have you back here again.
Thank you, and good morning.
I'm not used to seeing you in a green jacket. That's what the sheriff wears, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. You told Fox 4 that you inherited a dysfunctional department. What did you mean by that?
You know, what I meant by dysfunctional is that lack of policy, lack of a sense of urgency. And I shared with staff over and over before I came out publicly and talked about it. I wouldn't have been appointed at the time if it wasn't dysfunctional, because I was there because of some dysfunctional things that were going on. I got some pushback internally. I'm trying to make it an environment where it's not fear-based and it's respect-based. So I let people express their opinion. I encourage them. So some of the not just command staff, but others came to me and said, well, we didn't like how you portrayed the sheriff's department. And I explained to them what I just explained to you all. I'm here for that reason. If it wasn't dysfunctional, I wouldn't be there. Policies are outdated. Employees not providing adequate work or no work at all on payroll, and everyone knew about it. Those kind of things. And some of those, to me, is criminal activity. So, I still describe it as dysfunctional. But let me tell you, too, we have some very dedicated and motivated people within the sheriff's department, too. I just promoted Captain Michael Montgomery to major this morning, and he's been there 28 years. So we have some outstanding personnel at the sheriff's department.
You know, just to remind our listeners, Sheriff, the former sheriff, Mike Sharp, resigned in April amidst a sex scandal. That scandal came to light after his girlfriend sued the county for discrimination. Court papers state that Christine Lind received multiple promotions and pay raises while working under Sheriff Sharp, eventually becoming the highest paid civilian in the department. Is that one of the scandalous things you came across?
Yes, that was one of the ones that was known to everyone. Again, that's why I was there, and that's why I could describe them as being dysfunctional, as well as some being productive. And I like to say, too, on Sheriff Sharp's behalf, former Sheriff Sharp's behalf, that he did some good things. He had radio systems, updated the radio systems. They had some other new equipment for the deputies. And I came in at a good time because they received almost a 19% pay increase for the sworn member. So that'll help recruit and things like that. So he did some good things. So I don't want to take that away from him. He set it up for me to win in some areas.
But no question, you were shocked by what you came across after years at the city.
Absolutely. I sat in the parking lot a couple of days at the first couple of weeks and thinking, man, every week I'm finding out something. Just found out last week our recruitment efforts have been hampered, because if you didn't know someone within the sheriff's department, you didn't know to submit your application directly to the sheriff's department and not to HR. I looked on HR website numerous times, didn't see positions for deputies. And I started asking questions a couple of weeks ago, and I found out that if you knew someone, you just submitted your application directly to a captain, and he kept a file, and then that's how they would select their personnel. So now we have an applicant review panel, and I'll do all the hiring. After they go through a process, I'll actually select who comes on board.
Jackson County Sheriff Daryl Forte is my guest. You said that you came across something unethical or scandalous nearly every week. What were you talking about there?
Every and I stopped asking questions at a certain point because I needed to catch up. You know, I contacted some outside authorities for advice. I contacted a couple attorneys because so many things were coming up. I heard some things. And after I got elected, people started opening up even more, saying, you know, you need to look into this and look into that. I found out when I did a search of a Sunshine request at the Sheriff's Department for the records, I found out we had a retired colonel that was still a reserve person that they didn't tell me about. Still had a firearm, county issued firearm, county issued radio, and still a badge. And I didn't know about him. I was told that someone told anytime I asked for the reserve list to take his name off along with some other people. So I didn't know about it.
So you issued a Sunshine request for your own department?
Absolutely. And I found out that's how I found out that that particular person was a reserve officer, because he had communicated with someone saying, yes, I have a reserve status with Jackson County Sheriff's Department. That's how I found out, and some other things.
You know, who's responsible, Sheriff, when a department devolves the way this one appears to have done the last few years?
I think management. You know, you can't, you know, and I inherited now, and I'm not blaming anyone. I need to find out what's going on even further. So I can't blame anybody. I own this now, so I'll deal with everything that comes up.
So bottom line is you're trying to change a culture that you believe needs drastic changing.
Yes, and I have some of the people that's on board already with the Sheriff's Department. From day one, I knew they were on board. Some people wanted that. When I came in, it was just in the hallway in passing, thank you, I hope you get it. And then other conversations was, the conversation consisted of, I'd like to tell you some things, but we don't know how long you're going to be here. So I knew there was a problem, you know, and again, I'm finding out some things. I found out about the firearms when I asked for a firearms audit, when the last time an audit was conducted, and they told me all the firearms were accounted for. And somebody smirked a little bit, and I said, what's that about? And they said, well, all of them aren't. We still have some people that have some out, and that's how I found out.
And that's the fault of policies that are simply outdated, it sounds like.
Yes, and lack of integrity for some. And I was really frustrated the first couple of months, but then I found out when you have fear-based management, you had a lot of people just trying to hang on, and they had observed what happened to others that spoke up, so they elected just not the same thing, as they were in a survival mode. One captain explained it to me, sir, when you throw rocks up, boulders come down, so we mind our own business. That's what he told me.
So now the culture is you're encouraged to speak up. That's what you're suggesting here.
Absolutely. You know, the last administration had one grievance filed against them in 9 years. I've had one grievance in 4 months. So I look at that as progress. They're not afraid, and I want people, if you feel like you've been wronged, file a grievance against me or whomever. Because, that opens it up and showing that it's fair. The promotion that I made today, Captain Montgomery to Major, you know what? He's demonstrated over the years that he's competent, but he wasn't in the clique, so he didn't get promoted.
I want to cite some things that you have said publicly since taking over, Sheriff, and get you to comment here. You said the day you were sworn in May, there were three public information officers listed, and most people didn't even know about one of them. And the one PIO, the public information officer, they didn't know about, wasn't required to submit a time card or any documentation like that, but yet he was still paid regularly. What was that about?
That was true, and I found out about that when that person, I was there 3 weeks to the day, and someone came and said so-and-so quit. And I said, where does he sit? I've never seen this person. And I tried to meet everybody there within the first 3 weeks inside the building. And they said, it's a long story. I said, well, I have time. So we sat down. And in fairness to the gentleman that was a PIO, he did occasionally post something on social media or some things like that. But it wasn't 20 hours worth of work. You know, he posted some things.
So he was maybe a buddy of somebody who was getting a paycheck just because he was a buddy?
And that's what we perceived, because he didn't report to a captain within inside the organization as the organizational chart dictated. And when I talked to the captain about it, he said, sir, it's a long story. They bypassed me, and some of our part-time employees were told you don't have to submit a timesheet anymore. So he said they were out of it. And again, if you throw rocks up, boulders come down mentality. So nobody said anything. And I told him that was criminal. So if anything like that happens again, I ordered them. They need to report it, whether I'm involved or whomever, because that's not acceptable.
So I gather that public information officer is no longer employed.
No, he actually, that's how I found out that he was actually there on payroll, because I hadn't seen him the time I was there. Then I started asking questions, and other people hadn't seen him in years.
But he's off the force now.
Yes, he's.
Another example was another employee was paid 20 hours a week, yet had no spot within the sheriff's department. I mean, what does that mean? This employee had no spot in the department?
He wasn't assigned. Nobody knew. They knew who he was, but hadn't seen him in several years. He was getting a check. He didn't try to defend himself. I respect him. He went away quietly. He just didn't say anything else. And supposedly he was a former campaign manager for a former sheriff.
Mm. In another instance, Fortes, you've said a commander who retired from the sheriff's department in December was paid until March because of a comp time matter. What concerns you there?
You know, the county has a system where, and the sheriff's department doesn't fall under that system. They created their own system where they just, at the end of the week, submit their time to our timekeeper with no approval from anyone. They just submit it, and they can, supposedly, their standard within the sheriff's department, accumulate 90 hours. And this person had over 500 hours accumulated, and supposedly he was paid for 90 of it, and he stayed on the books for a lot of it. And he actually kept 100-something hours on the books when he actually signed out. Hmm. So, again, it just, you know, to me, it's fraud. It's a waste of taxpayers' dollars and things like that. And really no one seemed to, you know, no one seemed to have any problem with it. They're like, that's him. That's not us.
How much pushback have you had within the department when, as you've come in here and noticed these problems and made these changes, how's that gone over?
It hasn't been a lot to my face, but there's been some things and some comments said. And again, when I did a sunshine request for the emails, I learned some things. Some of the people that said, I'm glad you're here. I read their emails. They're not glad I'm there. I'm here. So again, you know, and I hadn't pointed it out to everybody. I hadn't told everybody what I found out. They know that I made a request for the emails because I told them. And because someone asked me, are you going to make this a regular pattern? I said, if I was going to make it a regular pattern, I probably wouldn't have told you. And this place is so small, you probably knew when I made the request. So there's no secrets there. There's no secrets.
When there's this much dysfunction, Sheriff, what effect does that have on the entire department?
I think it gives them hope now, though. I think it gives them hope that, and again, the promotion that I made today to major, the guy's been around a long time. He wasn't on any particular team. And I think when they see your promotions are based on merit and not who you're connected to and who you fish with or hunt with or associate with outside the organization, you still have a chance. I'm looking for workers. I'm looking for contributors. I'm looking for people that are customer-centric. That's what I'm looking for. So those will be the promotions that I make.
But when you see a department mired in amid all these problems, what impact does that have on morale and an employee's incentive to work hard?
It has a huge impact on morale. It's about 140 employees. About 108 of them are sworn members. I've met one-on-one, and they signed up. It wasn't required with over 70 of the employees. So over half the employees I've met one-on-one with, they kind of get their feel of that. And that's how I know it's a great organization, just from the half that I've talked to one-on-one, not counting the ones that I talked to in passing. So, again, I think we're not camping where they used to be. We're looking forward to figure out where we're going, and we're going to go together as a team.
Again, Jackson County Sheriff Darrell Forte is my guest. You also came across policies that needed updating. You've mentioned some of them this morning, Sheriff. But one policy was the sex offender policy, which you found out had not been updated since 1997.
Yes.
And tell us about that.
That was alarming. When I started asking questions about that, what are we doing for sex offender registration and enforcement? It was silent. And basically, I was told down the road it hadn't been a priority in years, so that's why we hadn't done anything with it.
When you took over as interim sheriff in May, there were 456 unaccounted for sex offenders because no one had been looking for them.
That's true. That's true.
It was 456.
There was no sense of urgency whatsoever. And within the last 2 weeks, again, the enforcement and the compliance efforts dropped again. I had to say something again Monday saying, hey, this is not just a program or project. This is what we're going to be about for a long time until we get those numbers down. So, again, we're going to reignite some motivation under some people.
Another example of an outdated policy, deputies were taking home department cars even though there was no policy that authorized it.
There was no, it was a oral authorization is what they told me, but there was no policy to guide what you can do off duty with your vehicle.
Again, a lack of leadership. You know, it's not often I have a leader of a major agency sitting across from me who's so upfront about the problems he or she has come across. This is kind of a remarkable moment for me, hearing you talk about it.
Well, thank you. And I can't share everything, because for legal reasons and other reasons, I can't share everything, but there's a lot more. But again, I want to emphasize, we have some great people within the Sheriff's Department. Yeah. It's just, you know, that fear-based management, I didn't allow some people to speak up. They were in the survival mode.
I'm wondering, Sheriff, what's different about being sheriff compared to being the police chief in Kansas City, Missouri?
A lot less stress.
Is that right?
Yeah, you know, versus 1,900 employees versus 140, very manageable. It's like having a division station back when I was a major back in 2000. You get to know most of the personnel by first name, know a little bit about them and the family. So I'm excited about the opportunity, and I plan on being around for a while. I'm not going to be a two-year sheriff. Might not even be a six-year sheriff. I might, you know, and with the term limits, I can stay until I'm 70. I'm 56 now. So I don't think I'll stay till I'm 70. But again, we'll take one day at a time. But I'll run again for sure. I'm not going to be able to do what needs to be done in these two remaining years on his term. So I'll be around for a while.
You know, you were known for working unholy numbers of hours when you were chief. You were on your motorcycle showing up at crime scenes at 2 in the morning, at 4 in the morning. How challenging, how demanding was that on you over as the years passed?
It was demanding, but, you know, like everyone else that's out there is dedicated to their profession, you really don't know until you stop. That was just part of who you are, and you love doing what you do. And I have a sheriff's motorcycle now, too, that I've been out on. When the weather breaks, I'll be back on it again. When it's your passion and your mission in life, it really doesn't seem like work.
Yeah. You know, when you retired from the police department, was that for 30 years of service?
31.
31. And you went back to law school. Have you finished law school yet?
No, and I probably won't be able to finish. I'll have the jail effective January 1st, the management and administration and operation of the jail. So that's going to take a lot of energy, too. So it wouldn't be fair to me, my family, to try to do all these things and do it right. So, I haven't made up my mind yet. I have until January to decide if I want to enroll again. I have final on Monday, a week from this Monday, past Monday. So I'll have to reevaluate again, but it won't be fair for me to take that much time away from my family again and not be able to give 100% at the sheriff's office and the jail.
You were referring to the voter-approved amendment, I guess, to the county charter that now gives you control of the county jail. The county executive has had control of it. Now it's shifting over to the sheriff. What kind of shape is the jail in? There's been lots of stories in the newspaper, on TV, about all kinds of problems, filth in the jail. Where is it today?
You know what? It's changed some. You know, as I talked to the director, Turner, over there, I've communicated with her from the first week after I was appointed by County Executive Frank White. And I want to thank him publicly, too, for giving me that opportunity to even be in the running for the election. But I've talked to her on a regular basis. They have a plan. They're working off some of the task force recommendations, so they're doing some things. I won't actually take over the administration and management of the jail until January 1st, but we've been communicating regularly. I plan to be there often early on. I can't talk about exactly what we're going to do yet because I want to make sure I share it with some other people. But I'm excited about it, and there's some things we can do. One of the things I'll do, I haven't shared it with everybody yet, but I'll start an inmate advisory council. I want to be able to talk to the inmates that are in there. I'll do, just as I did at the sheriff's department, one-on-one conversations with personnel in the jail. I think there's 350 or so. I'll let them sign up if they want to talk to me about something. So I'll spend a lot of time assessing and continue to gather information.
To what extent is Jackson County on track today to build a new jail in the years to come?
They're really not on track. You know, we had a lot of conversation. I talked to three elected officials last week. The consultants talk about if we build another jail, it's going to probably cost operating costs $60 to $90 million a year. Currently, we're paying about $30, $31 million. We don't know where we get those funds from yet. Again, that's something that I'll have to assess once I get there. I'll make the recommendation to the elected officials when we get to that point. But again, and another jail, depending on how many beds there, whether it be 1,000 or 2,000, we'll probably fill up right away. And they're talking about, for a facility, $190 million to $200 million or so, depending on who you talk to and when you talk to them. So again, that's some things that we'll have to look at. But what I'm focusing on right now is what we have now, making that safe, secure, and sanitary for everybody that's involved there.
Is it your personal belief, Sheriff, that we need a new county jail? And this would replace the one that's downtown at, what, 13th and Oak, I think?
Yes.
Yeah. Do we need a new jail?
Yeah. You know, based on what I know at this point, and again, I haven't been intimately involved, but the things that I've read and the research that I've done, absolutely, we need another jail. You know, you need a one-level jail. You need a jail that you have adequate space for recreation, because that causes a lot of problems when you're overcrowded and don't have recreation space. You need a chapel. You need some other things in there, you know. And I think when we do something like that, and even if we keep what we have now, if we change the image by doing what's right for the people at the jail and our residents, I think that will help with recruiting and have a detailed recruiting and retention plan. So I have some ideas for that also.
You know, there's some belief that a new jail being on one level, more line of sight, sort of supervision possibilities, that the number of jail employees that would be needed would actually decline because it would be a different jail, a different layout altogether. Is that true?
You know, from the research and the information that I've gathered, yes, that's true. But I want to also share this publicly that we're already short staffed for correctional officers and things like that. So it might not lead to elimination of positions, because it might just help right size us.
Okay. Why did you want to get involved with the sheriff's department? You thanked Frank White for giving you the opportunity. What was it about becoming sheriff that was appealing to you?
It was nothing at first. You know, when I first found out about the former sheriff, what was going on, I got calls as the media started putting information out. I believe that Tuesday morning I started getting calls, and my answer was, why would I do that to myself again? I'm done. I'm in law school. I fish when I want to. I do what I want to do. I have no interest in that. And then I started talking to different people, and an older guy, Price Chopper in Lee Summit, said something to me that touched me after a few people said it, and I prayed about it. And he said, it's not about you. He said, you have something to offer, and I think you do well there. And I was impressed with him, because he knew what college I went to and what high school I went to. So I'm thinking, he said he followed me. So I went to the car. I texted my wife and said, you know what I think about putting in for? And her text, I still have it on the phone. I'll support you in whatever you do. And that's when I went home and updated my resume, and the rest is history.
You know, Chief, we haven't even talked about crime yet in the county compared to the city. What is happening out there? What is happening in terms of crime rates? And what do you see in Jackson County that's different from the kinds of issues that you dealt with when you were police chief of Kansas City?
It's a lot less crime when you talk about the unincorporated areas. Mm-hmm. And that's where we didn't have municipal government. So we go in there and we do the law enforcement services. A lot less crime. And that's what I'm excited too about, because we can take our time and we can do the community policing there. And to me, all of us are community policing officers. And all it is having a problem with a partnership and holding one accountable. We don't need a 15-page definition of community policing. And I stress that over and over. And just Monday, but the school was closed that we were going to meet at, we were going to start a community policing project over at Salem East neighborhood.
Hmm. Is there any one particular crime problem that has you concerned right now?
Burglaries, burglaries in the unincorporated areas.
That's a perennial problem for the sheriff, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And we're doing some things to address that, too. We hadn't had, you know, and this is another thing, and I don't want to bash the sheriff's department, but I'll tell you the truth about them. They didn't have crime stats before I got there. I wanted to see the crime stats about, you know, where our problem areas are, and even the areas that we're adjacent to. There were no crime stats distributed to the deputy. So we started that so they know where the crime problems are and things like that. But just common sense things like that where it doesn't take a lot of, you know, a lot of motivation to come up with that. Some of our deputies out there, give them credit, they were looking up things. As I talked to them, they said, yeah, we know we have a problem over here, here, and here. So how do you know that? Well, I went and looked at the reports. But if they didn't take the initiative, and a lot of them didn't, they didn't know what was going on out there.
Well, that's Jackson County Sheriff Daryl Forte, who's now on the job there. He's taking on the county jail here in just a few weeks. Sheriff, so good to have you here again. Sure, appreciate it. Come back and visit again.
Thank you.
Okay. Time for a break. When we come back, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier Doug Frost will be here. We'll talk about sparkling wine for the holidays. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we talked with playwright and professor Sarah Rule about her bond with a terminally ill student. Hear that and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, historian Michael Beschloss discusses American presidents, how they have led this country into war, and how the pressures of those conflicts affected them. Join us for KCUR's Up to Date tomorrow. It's that time of year when sparkling wines are front and center at many a holiday party, and why not? Today, a conversation about what's been called the most technical wine in the world. Our guest, once again, Doug Frost, who's been both a master sommelier and a master of wine. There are only four on the entire planet, and just for the record, the Wine Spectator's also bestowed the accolade of Master of Spirits on Doug, who's one of the founders of BAR. That's the Beverage Alcohol Resource, considered by many industry professionals to be the preeminent education and examining body for the spirits and cocktail industry. Doug, happy holidays. Always great to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be back.
And you're wasting no time pouring it right up here.
No, let's not mess around. Let's get to it.
What are you pouring?
Well, I've got a little bit of Prosecco. Prosecco is a not just a wine, but it's a place. And yeah, it's a place in northern Italy. And this is a producer called Bisol, specifically a bottling they called Yeo. And it's a grape called Lera, although for a long time we called it Prosecco grape. But yeah, it really is a distinct grape called Lera. And it is sort of the epitome of just the as friendly as can be, I'd have to admit, slightly simple, but easy to throw down a glass of bubbly.
Slightly simple, easy to throw down. Danny Alexander, our producer, is sampling some right now.
Yes,
what
I
do you,
am.
What do you think, ma'am?
Actually, I agree. It is. It's very clean. It's very simple. But boy, it's just so beautifully balanced, too. Just like, I have to ask, I have seen or heard where Prosecco is, a lot of people will drop a sugar cube in a glass. What is that all about? I don't know why you would do that.
You know, I am still reminded of a movie, I think it was called Moonstruck, years and years ago. Yeah. And it was all about an Italian family in the boroughs in New York. And they're about to have a big celebration, and they pull out a bottle of Mum Cordon Rouge. And I turned to my wife and I said, well, this is utter BS. I mean, there's no Italian family would be drinking Mum Cordon Rouge. And then they all picked up a sugar cube
and dropped it
in
a glass.
Okay, now that's real. You know? I mean, it's just people like sweet things. Mm. And certainly Prosecco, once upon a time, Prosecco was always dry. What we're seeing today with this explosion of Prosecco, because it's just gone crazy, is people are making sweeter and sweeter versions of Prosecco. This one's not. You know, to me, this one's nice and clean and dry, almost tastes a little bit like apple.
And I'm a fan of the brut, of the more brut, yeah.
Yeah, a little lemon. But some people want things sweeter. Heck, you know, if you want it sweeter, go for it, man. Why not?
One of our reporters, Ellie Moxley, is also here. Can you match Danny's lingo here?
Well,
wonderfully
first,
balanced.
I want to say
this
today
stuff,
she's not here as a reporter. Today she is here as an aficionado of the bubbly. This girl loves her bubbles.
Okay. I do love my bubbly, and I will be the first to admit that I am one of those people that does enjoy a sweeter bubbly. But what I actually like about this one is that Danny's right. It's not on that sweeter side, but I feel like it'd be one that'd be a good crowd pleaser because I really like it as someone who likes the sweeter bubbles, but I could also see, you know, my sister who loves her brutes, you know, enjoying this as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, make a case, Doug, for the wonders of sparkling wines. What's the case for them?
Well, the thing that we say in the restaurant business is that sparkling wine goes with anything. Mm-hmm. That you can put it with any kind of food at all, and I think that's absolutely true because it has the scrubby bubbles. You know, the whole idea of wine and food or any beverage and food really is that the two should they shouldn't mirror each other. They should work in some ways complementary, but also to some degree against each other. In other words, I would like that first bite of let me put it this way: that first bite of prime rib is one of the greatest things on the planet.
Right.
If you like meat, you know, yeah, it's just like, oh my god, that tastes so good. And by the second or third bite, your brain has gone through adaptation, and other psychological and physiological activities happen that basically turn some of the intensity of the flavor off. So you throw wine in there to cleanse the mouth of all those flavors and aromas, so every bite is like the first bite again. And and to me, that's, you know, what wine's supposed to do. And the scrubby bubbles do it in far better than, you know, still wine would.
So it's like mouthwash is what you're saying.
It's really delicious mouthwash.
Mouthwash.
Yeah.
We hope. Anyway, it's supposed to be delicious mouthwash.
Have you ever thought about it that way before, Danny?
No, I have not. But what I do like about sparkling wines is that they can be dual purpose. You can have them as an aperitif before your meal. You can serve them as with your desserts if you want. So they're very, very versatile, and they go with so many foods. And I also like what they do. They do exactly that. They will balance. Something like this Prosecco that we just had, I think, is a great balancer if you're serving something that's a little heavy or viscous. Or a little fatty, I think it would be great. And perfect. I would love to serve this like with an appetizer board. I think it would be just stunning. just personally
Your
speaking.
Your mind is just working overtime here.
You know,
You've
when it
got
comes...
this all planned out here already, don't
in
you?
In my head, I drink
Danny,
that, I'm like,
why
oh.
didn't you make us a cheese plate?
Well,
Very good question, yeah. And if our listeners want to chime in with questions about sparkling wines, they're welcome to do it right now. 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Why is sparkling wine, Doug, called the most technical wine in the world?
Well, it is certainly the sort of wine that amateurs are unlikely to make well, because in essence what you're doing is you're taking a wine, a standard still wine, and you're putting it back into a bottle, at least if you're making wine the so-called official method champenoise manner, or method traditionnel, as they say. You're going to take a still wine, you're going to put it back in a bottle, and you're going to put a little bit of yeast in there and a little bit of sugar so that the yeast can create more carbon dioxide. That yeast certainly create alcohol. They convert sugar to alcohol and some heat, but they, importantly for sparkling wine and for beer, they create bubbles as well, carbon dioxide bubbles. So you've got to know just the right amount. And then when you're done with that, typically with champagne, people are going to actually try to get those dead yeast cells out of the bottom of the bottle. In the case of inexpensive wines, inexpensive sparkling wine, that'll probably be done in a big tank. They'll filter it out, much the same way they would handle beer. But in the case of expensive champagne, you know, actual champagne and high-end sparkling wine, they'll do it in an individual bottle, and then they have to essentially shake the bottle, move the bottle over a series of days or weeks to try to get the yeast down into the neck of the bottle as it's upside down, and then you freeze that neck solid, and then you pop the Coca-Cola top, which is what they use in the short term, off the top of the bottle, and the pressure blows that plug of dead yeast cells out of the bottle. Well, you got to fill it up with some because it's missing some wine now. So then you'll usually fill it with wine, and in the case of champagne, certainly a little bit of sugar as well.
Sparkling wine comes in several different styles. Tick them off for us. What are we talking about here?
Well, the classic style is called Brut. It just means it's your standard, and your standard is typically blended from several different grapes. Again, if we're talking about champagne, so Pinot Noir, a red grape; Pinot Meunier, a red grape; and Chardonnay. A white grape, blended in different proportions depending upon who you are, where you get your grapes from. And then you'll blend different vintages together as well, because it's so difficult to grow grapes in the Champagne region that you're not going to get a good harvest every year. This year's a fantastic harvest, but last year, not so much. So it's one of those situations where for centuries now, they've realized that blending different vintages together allows you to make a very consistent wine. Again, you come back to the Brut. Now, what I brought with me is Tattinger, the Brut La Française, and it's a blend of different vintages, four or five different vintages, and trying to make that consistent thing. But in the short term, I poured another little French bubbly called Crémant de Jura. It's a Crémant. That's just the French term for a sparkling wine made in the method champenoise, but they don't want you to call it champagne. It doesn't come from champagne. It comes from up in the hills closer to
Because only champagne can be called champagne if it comes from that region of France, right?
It's supposed to be that way, but there are still some wineries in California that are grandfathered in, call their wine a champagne, which is I always thought it was kind of crazy that the champenoise themselves kept suing the U.S. over the use of the word champagne. When I thought, this is super simple. All you do is you start making a wine from France called Napa Valley, and we'll come to the negotiating table pretty quickly. But no, they never did that.
Ellie Moxley, are you keeping up with all this? Are you on top of the game here?
You know, I'm trying to keep up with all of this. I will say I might like this one just a slight bit less than the first one. I was a big fan of that first one. One of the things that I'm always curious about is I think when we think of like bubbles here, we think about New Year's, and I am of the opinion we should drink bubbles way more often than that. Sparkling wines far more often.
I love the way you think.
What kind of controls? Like, I know that like sometimes when you'll pour yourself a glass of sparkling wine, it's really sparkling. It's really got those bubbles. You can kind of see it. I don't know if fizzing is the correct term. Others it looks a little more still. It's a little closer to a glass of still wine. What kind of determines whether you've got that crazy bubble going on?
Well, it certainly it's going to have a lot to do with how fresh that wine is. And I tend to age my champagnes for 2 or 3 or 4 years sometimes in the basement. I have some down there that have been there for 10 years or more. So I'm not as worried about the bubbles, because those bubbles will begin to dissipate. I think other more intriguing flavors, but most people would prefer, to, as you say, to have a fresher wine. And this wine isn't absolutely isn't as fresh. This Crema de Jura, it's from a guy named Hubert Clavelin. Some of the Chardonnay in it has been aged in barrels, so it's already showing kind of a bruised apple flavor from that. And then they'll leave the wine on the yeast cells for a good period of time. So the major difference between these two wines is that Prosecco was made in a big tank, and this wine is made in the individual bottle. And it becomes certainly more mushroomy, less fresh. We think of it as sometimes a brioche flavor or a slightly, you know, toasted biscuit kind of flavor.
And clearly Ellie picked up on that because you weren't as crazy about this glass.
No, and now that he says that it was, you know, Chardonnay, I will admit that that is not my favorite type of wine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now I thought that I was kind of tasting a little bit of that, and I wasn't wrong.
Danny?
No, you're right.
So I have a question, and one it described for me the different note. It hit me on the nose first, much more so than the Prosecco did. I noticed the distinction there. But the leaving it in the bottle, I was is it on the lees? Is that the term I'm thinking
yes,
of?
Yes.
And it's supposed to make it creamier?
It does definitely add to the texture and make it creamier. And the lees are just the dead yeast cells. Mm-hmm. That's the fancy term for that. It adds to the complexity, but it also detracts from the freshness. Mm-hmm. So when people say, which often happens to me, people are like, well, I only like sparkling wine when it's made by the method champenoise, the champagne method, because those other ones are just cheap bubblies. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Those, what their merit is they have a freshness. There's a, you know, that Prosecco tastes like one of those damn grapes I plucked off the vine. I mean, it really is quite remarkable. And a Moscato, you know, a sparkling Moscato or Moscato d'Asti or Asti Spumanti, those are made in this tank method as well because you want freshness. You don't want that weird kind of mushroomy creaminess. You want that
liveliness. I happen to like it.
Can I just note that Danny Alexander is displaying a level of sophistication that's eluded me up until this point after all these years of knowing you.
You don't drink with Danny enough.
I don't drink with Danny enough. 816-235-2888. Our number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Jake from South Kansas City, good morning.
Yes, a pleasant good morning, and thanks for your combined knowledge. The Missouri sparklings, who among our vintners, you know, produces a nice bottle at a decent price? And, you know, you all haven't touched, I don't believe, on the price range. You know, what should we pay for something palatable? For an unsophisticated palate.
Great question. How about price range? And talk to us about Missouri sparkling wines, Doug.
Absolutely, Jake. I really, really agree with you. It's price point is important to almost all of us. I certainly tell people when they're like, I just want some bubbly. I don't want to pay a lot of money for it. I'm like, Domaine St. Michel from Washington State. I mean, that stuff's usually $12 a bottle, and it's for real. But to your point, Stone Hill makes a really good sparkling wine. I don't remember the price offhand. I'm sure it's close to $20 or something like that. Les Bourgeois makes a delicious sparkling wine. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I just talked those guys into making a sparkling Chamberson Pet Nat, which isn't for sale yet. I don't know when they'll have it for sale. But
oh, you terrible tease you.
I know. Well, I've always thought it would be really fun. And I think more Missouri wineries should play around with Pet Nat. Pet Nat is this kind of new cool category. It's short for Petillon Naturellement. So it just means naturally sparkling wine. And what
say
it is.
Say that three times fast.
Yeah.
What don't it is. Put that is, in a promo.
It's like a bottle conditioned beer. You just leave the yeast in the bottle and then they do their work. And so it's not a technical wine, to your point. It's a very untechnical wine. It's like old school sparkling winemaking. In fact, somebody in France was doing this almost 1,000 years ago this way. And so Pet Nat is burgeoning with the sort of natural movement, the natural wine movement. And Claverack out of St. Louis or near St. Louis makes a really delicious one, which, of course, you can't get either. So that's why I was like, come on, guys, make one here. And they're making it out of a red grape. So that should be fun. But I like their stuff. I think Herman Hoff makes a sparkling in Missouri as well. I think, indeed, I really do believe that the grapes that we grow here make a really nice sparkling wine.
How about price range?
You're $12 to $20. And now if we're talking about this Yeo Prosecco, that's probably going to be $15 to $18. And this Crema de Jura is going to probably run you $22 to $26. And then Tattinger, real champagne is always going to run you close to $40.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 816-235-2888 is our number. If you haven't had a chance to be with Doug during one of his presentations around town, you ought to try it. And one is coming up here in just a couple weeks that might be worth your time. In fact, Doug will be talking about connections between World War One and Champaign during a conversation at the World War One Museum at 6:30 in the evening on December 6th. More information, just go to the World War One Museum's website, and there'll be a link on our webpage as well. December 6th, 6:30 in the evening, a chance to hear and be with Doug Frost. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. We have a third wine that's been poured here, and Danny, you're holding it up to the light and thinking about it hard.
I am thinking about it hard.
A lot of bubbles in this one.
This one struck me exploding
with bubbles.
This one struck me as tartar. Mm-hmm. A little more citrusy, I would say. Again, this is what I love about most sparkling wines. They're very clean. They have they're not cloying. They don't stick on your tongue.
I agree.
Yeah, they're very refreshing. Ellie, what do you think?
I'm just amazed.
Is that whole? Wow.
I poured a small pour this time.
Oh yeah. Okay. Sure.
This time, you know, I really like what you said about that. You know. Clean and not cloying, because I really think that that's kind of where sweeter wines get a bad rap sometimes, is it's that aftertaste, it's that mouthfeel, it's the fact that, you know, that sweetness just keeps lingering, and if you don't like that, you're not going to like just drinking the wine straight either. But that's kind of why I like the sweeter sparklings, because a lot of them can be sweet, but not have that, you know, kind of cloying taste that you would, you know, kind of keep on your tongue for a long time.
Those scrubby bubbles again. I mean, they really do. Most people don't realize this is an actual champagne. Most people don't realize how sweet real champagne is. I certainly, you know, I've never done this, but let's say on a New Year's Eve when you lose track of where your glass is and you find it at about 1 in the morning and you're like, oh, there it is, you know, and it's still filled with champagne and you drink it and then you think, well, that can't be my champagne because it doesn't have any bubbles and it tastes sweet now. The bubbles give the sensation of dryness. So almost all champagnes are made with a touch of sweetness or more to make them seem more balanced. Certainly, your first comment was how citrusy this is. This is champagne. It has probably 1.5% residual sugar in it. And yet, it doesn't really taste sweet. If it didn't have that sugar, it would probably taste slightly bitter or really, really racy.
You know, can I nominate Ellie and Danny for your next Master of Wine class? I think both of these, I think they would be excellent students.
Then we'd have to get Lisa Rodriguez in here as well.
Oh, there you go. Okay, let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Pat from Shawnee. Pat, you're on the air with Doug Frost. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. My comment is about one way to get more people to drink sparkling wine. In Europe, a very common aperitif is a Kira Royale, K-I-R.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And, yeah, you see them around here, but not as often. It's just champagne with a dollop of either cassis or a lot of people use Chambord. Mm-hmm. And that's a real nice way to introduce people to use sparkling wine.
It's a delicious drink, and it is. It's a great drink. It's a traditional drink, really, and I think we should see more of those. It's particularly really good with chocolates and things like that at dessert, depending upon how much Chambord or cassis you put in there. I echo it 100%.
And I don't think people think that that you can actually mix champagne with other things, you know, as a mixed drink, and I think it escapes people. Most people think of the mimosa as one way to do it, but I'm like,
One of the great cocktails, the champagne cocktail, is a great classic, and you're just dropping a sugar cube in there and Angostura bitters. So it's really the ancient style of cocktailing, or at least the 19th century style of cocktailing, a bittered sling, as we would call it.
Pat, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, bye-bye. Let's go to Steve from Northeast Kansas City. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello. Let us not forget Miller's. The champagne,
a bottle. There you go. You know, I don't think the Champenoise appreciated that tagline, but it certainly still sticks in our brains, doesn't it?
Yeah. Anything else about this latest pour that we have in front of us here, Ellie? Anything else you want to say about it?
Where would you rate it among the three that we've had?
I still think the first might be my favorite. I like this one better than the one that came from the Chardonnay grape.
Okay. Hey, how many levels of sweetness are there in sparkling wines, Doug?
Well,
what are we looking at here?
You can have the so-called bone dry, which is non-dosage, Brut 00 dosage, Brut, which is the standard, then extra dry, which contradictory, you know.
It's not as dry as you would think.
It's actually sweeter. So it gives you a sense. Extra dry becomes an issue in the early 20th century, post-prohibition, really, I should say, mid-century, because we are so used to drinking such sweet champagne. If you go back to champagnes of the 19th century, some of them were intensely sweet, 5% residual sugar. The famous Russian flavor, it was called the Gurus, could have 12 or 15% residual sugar. People were drinking much sweeter champagnes back then. So it's all over the board. And certainly, as I say, with Prosecco, once upon a time, you believed it was dry. Now it can be slightly sweet to kind of sweet. Moscato d'Asti and Asti Spumante are distinctly sweet sparkling wines.
You know, based on sales, are we seeing Americans gravitate towards more sweeter wines, less sweet, drier wines? What are you seeing?
Americans continue to, if we look at the numbers themselves, continue to gravitate towards drier wines. I think that's more of an accident of purchasing, which is people are spending more money. They're buying better wines and less of them. So they're not buying the so-called bulk wines as frequently as they used to. And those wines were always distinctly sweet. Mm-hmm. So if you want to look at the naked numbers, people really are still enjoying dry wines to an increasing degree.
And I have to say, I've always been more of a Brut than a – but there's also Semi-Dec and then there's Dieu. And Dieu,
it's for dessert.
Yeah.
And Demi-Sec is probably for dessert as well.
Yeah. And I have to get used to those. I've never been overly attracted to sweet, so it's rare that I would even have those, much less drink them, I have to say. But –
do the bubbles occur naturally in all sparkling wines?
Fermentation is a very complex process, but the three factors it creates are alcohol, carbon dioxide, and heat. So in most cases in wine, you have an open-top fermenter. The bubbles just dissipate. The carbon dioxide dissipates into the air. And indeed, every year somewhere in the world, someone dies during winemaking because a lot of these old wineries are cooped up and the carbon dioxide will build up. And it'll take you out if you're I had a winemaker grab me by the belt once and say, go ahead, just stick your head down in that vat and see how that works out for you. And I thought somebody clocked me in the face. I mean, it honestly felt like somebody had hit me in the head and I came up with stars. And he was like, that's how quickly you die if you're not careful around here. It's like,
oh, that takes my breath away.
So it's
still, it does not put me off drinking my wine.
No. This is something we're talking about fermentation, on a commercial scale. We're not talking about somebody drinking wine. It won't hurt you unless you drink too much.
Well, let's wrap up here. What kinds of sparkling wines are you recommending for the holidays? Just to sort of summarize where we've been here today.
I think that people should be willing to try at all price points, whether it is a local wine, which you can get for usually under $20 or so, whether it is a champagne that it's going to cost you $35 or $45 or $50. Play around. Try some different things. Prosecco is kind of the king right now. But interestingly, I work – one of the places I work with is the restaurant at 1900. And we've been pouring Prosecco since we opened in May. And then we switched to this – funny Chardonnay from Jura because I wanted to show something that has a bit more character. Prosecco's everywhere. And so that's great. If Prosecco's what you like, keep doing that. But I think experiment. Have some fun.
Well, Doug Frost, again, you can see and hear him December 6th at the National World War I Museum. Go online to check out that event. He'll also be in conversation with Vicki Rehm, author of The Wine Table. That'll be on Wednesday, December 12th at the 1900 building. Doug just mentioned it, 1900 Shawnee Mission Parkway. Doug, you're a treasure. Always great to have you here. Sure appreciate it.
Hey, happy holidays to you.
Ellie Moxley, Danny Alexander, thanks for coming in and doing the hard work of sampling the wine here today, too. Tomorrow on the show, historian Michael Beschloss will be here. He'll give us an inside look at American presidents who have taken us into war. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.